This is Professor Friedman's contracts class in room 230.
Thank you. We have the question on page 265 at the top. There are at least two less tortured ways of construing 2708 to solve the lost volume difficulty. Let's open to 2708. How would you do it? Ms. Jackson, what? I'm not surprised. At the top of page 265, in the first full paragraph, there is a question about 2708. So I suggested that we open to 2708. It says there are at least two less tortured ways of reading that provision to give rights to the lost volume seller. What would they be? All right, you are responsible for that. Then on page 266, at the end of note 5, the question is raised with regard to whether a deposit might be viewed as a liquidated damages provision. That is, the buyer gives the seller a sum of money as a deposit. And not infrequently, the understanding is, if I default, you keep that as liquidated damages, although it is not necessarily stated that way. And in fact, in Wallace against Smith, that was exactly what happened. That you're told back then in the note that it was a liquidated damages provision. The court decided that, although the contract did not call the deposit liquidated damages. So, but it can happen, obviously. So the issue wasn't raised here. Diasonics could have said, we're entitled to keep the $300,000 as liquidated damages. Or Davis could have said, we don't have to pay the lost expectancy. All we have to do is forfeit the $300,000 instead of paying over $3 million in lost profits, lost consequential damages. Something over $300,000. What the hell was it? It's in a footnote. What number did I give you from the later case?
Footnote 6.
Yeah, what does it say?
Yeah,
$453,000 that Davis had to pay. Why didn't Davis argue? You get to keep the $300,000, the $300,000, but you don't get $400,000. Or why didn't Diasonics say we don't have to give you back that money? That's liquidated damages. Neither side could have relied on that argument. Neither did. Why? The common sense. Ms. Levin?
Well, in some cases, these deposits are more like an initial investment to help.
Well, that's true, but that's what would be argued. That's what would be argued by whichever side did not want to call it liquidated damages. But why didn't one side at least raise the issue? You're Mr. Sandler.
I am.
Good. You changed your seat. Excellent.
Because it's stipulated in 27181 about whether or not it was the liquidated damages are a reasonable anticipation or in light of the actual damage, and there was no actual damage.
Well, there was in terms of lost profits there were, and certainly in terms of anticipation, it was not an unreasonable figure, was it? But again, that's something that would be argued if the issue were raised. It could go either way. As I said, either side could have raised it. It could have come out either way, but neither side even raised the issue. Davis could have saved $400,000. And Diasonics could have avoided all of litigation simply by saying we're going to keep it as liquidated damages when they were first sued instead of counterclaiming, or as a fallback in addition to counterclaiming. Hi, are you Mr. Durham? Oh, that's wonderful. Everybody changes seats. That's really good. Thank you.
They wouldn't mention it in their contract because the other side would be less likely, Davis would be less likely to enter into an agreement if they had said, you have to.
That's an argument. That's an argument if the issue is raised. The question is, why didn't at least one of these sides raise the issue? Why didn't at least one of them say it's liquidated damages? That's the end of it. Ms. Franco?
I think that it would be hard to show that it was liquidated damages and not a penalty.
Well, I first of all, I don't think it would be. But, and get rid of the question mark, if you will, please. I don't think it would be, but that is not necessarily a reason not to raise it. Again, it can be argued either way. There's no question. Mr. Cade?
Davis thought that they wouldn't have to pay anything, and Diasonics thought that they could get the $453,000.
Yeah, it's common sense. Just common sense. Each one was simply rolling the dice for the best possible result. And neither wanted to raise the liquidated damages issue even as a fallback. So if you're winning on it, rather than winning on either paying nothing getting the big number. It was a tactical decision. And I said earlier, when we were talking about the adversary system, that sometimes it doesn't work the way theoretically it should. Here is a situation where neither of the adversaries chose to raise an issue that certainly could have been raised. And the reason was a tactical reason. Now, that doesn't mean necessarily that the adversary system has failed, because they ought to be entitled to argue their case as they want to argue it. But nevertheless, the theory that with each side raising every issue, seeking out all the relevant facts, raising all of the law, legal and policy issues that can be raised, that the trier of fact is in the best position to resolve the case. And that might necessarily be so, depending on the tactics. And I think that's pretty clearly what happened here. Oh, and then we have the questions following the note on the Mattachine Society, or the question. When I was negotiating with the lawyer for the Manger Hotel, did I do anything unethical? Ms. Adler? You did it to me, didn't you?
No, not her. They took our seats.
What? What? Yeah, did you guys switch seats on me? What? Did you? Yeah, I wondered when you came in. I really did. That's pretty good. Okay. So you're Ms. Greenfield. What? What? Oh, wait a minute. Or are you? Wait, what?
Yeah, Greenfield.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. All right. But, and then Mr. Corgett sitting next to you?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. All right. That's good. It's good. All right. This is Greenfield.
Well, the thing that I thought was a little...
Loud, if you will.
You sort of made a false statement to the other lawyer when he asked you how you were doing mitigating the damages, and you said that you hadn't gotten any hotels yet. But right before that, somebody called you and said that you got them now. So I was kind of curious if that's considered, if that is unethical or not.
Well, is it or isn't it?
Well, I thought it would be, but there would be actually no way of them knowing. So, I don't know. That's what I was curious about. I was thinking about this a lot, actually.
but you didn't resolve it.
I thought it was unethical. Yeah.
What? But what?
They told
moi?
They told you that they asked you specifically if you had found another place, and you said no. But right before then, somebody called you and said you had found it.
Yeah. you change your hair? Yeah, you're Ms. Washira, right? Okay, good.
What you did, I don't believe was unethical.
Thank you very much. Why? What?
Because it says in comment 4.1 that estimates of price or value placed on the subject of and the party's intention as to an acceptable settlement of the claim.
A little slower, a little louder, please.
The intentions, a party's intentions as to an acceptable settlement of a claim are in the category of things that don't constitute a material fact. And because only material facts are making a false statement of material fact would be something that would be unethical because it's not a material fact, it wouldn't be.
Was it not a material fact whether we had mitigated the damages? Now, it, of course, when I had been authorized to, told to try to get as much as 1,000, and we weren't sure that we could get anything, and they immediately opened up with $1,000, and I said, don't be silly. We're talking at least five figures here. That, I suppose, would be covered. That lie is not a lie because it's a convention. If you call a lie a convention, it's not a lie. Under lawyer's ethics. Well, that's the way it works, under lawyer's ethics. But what about Ms. Greenfield's scurrilous suggestion? Ms. Manning?
Well, when the lawyer asked you, are your efforts coming along, and you said nothing definite yet, you weren't lying because you still had a book, the Shuttlebuses. You still had a book, the Shuttlebuses.
You still what?
The way I read it, you hadn't completely negotiated with the other hotel yet. Didn't you still have to book the Shuttlebuses?
Kennedy
had
signed the contract.
Well, even by saying nothing definite yet, aren't you just evading the question and not lying? Shouldn't it be his responsibility to ask more of a specific question to you?
What do you mean by definite?
Well, he says, how are your efforts coming? He didn't say, have you...
We're not making any anymore. How would that be? He might say, what is meaning? Well, why not? Nobody's offended. yeah. Ms. Adler?
Yeah.
Oh, boy, good. That was very good.
I think that if you had given a more definite answer, you could have gotten your client into sort of trouble and maybe ended up with malpractice.
If my client was in trouble,
your client would have ended up worse off.
There's a good possibility that the lawyer on the other side would have said, "Terrific! Then we don't owe you anything."
Exactly.
Yes.
So by doing what you did, you allowed your client to come out better off because of your involvement.
Yeah, what about that?
I like that.
You like that.
But you were only supposed to get 1,000, you got them 2,000. They were going to be happy.
I was supposed to get 1,000?
No, they were going to be happy with 1,000, you got them 2,000.
Yeah. Yeah, but I would have lost it if I told the truth.
Yeah, you should have lied to
them. Ms. Moran?
Well, your obligation is to get your client the most money possible. So, just because they wanted to get a certain amount of money doesn't mean that you're getting more than that would be unethical.
No, but we're not talking about whether I got more or less. The question is how I got it.
For mitigation damages, the amount of money that you get is kind of a concern.
So if I had said, as I've been telling you all along, it's just impossible to find another hotel in Washington this late on such short notice. What if I'd said that?
Well,
no problem with that?
If you said that, you might have been deceiving them.
I see. But when I said nothing definite yet, I wasn't deceiving them.
No, absolutely not.
Why not?
Because there could have been extraneous costs to get everyone to the other hotel.
The what?
There could have been other costs to get people to the other hotel. The deal was never done.
No, the deal was done with the other hotel. There certainly were minor costs. We had to have a couple of buses or something at the manger for the people who showed up at the wrong hotel. But I don't know that makes what I said truthful. Ms. Vashera?
Also, I believe that you're not lying when you say nothing definite yet, because
conversation with this new second hotel that you were with when you signed the contract with the first. The actual event hasn't happened yet. So they're still in a position where...
Yeah, we thought that one was definite. Yeah, we thought that was definite. It wasn't. Yeah. No, nothing is definite in life. I like that. Yeah, how about that? Well, you know, the problem, in all candor, the problem was that when I went to law school, I think I've told you, there were no ethics courses, nothing serious, nothing that would raise this issue, or the perjurious client problem, or whether you should give your client advice that might tempt the client to commit perjury or do something else improper. These issues were ignored, and the theory was, apparently, it was better not to discuss them publicly. And you get out into practice, and all of a sudden you find, I mean, that's the way it was, you would find yourself faced with one of these issues with somebody else on the end of a telephone. Or you're in a courtroom, and all of a sudden your witness lies. Or whatever it may be. And we didn't discuss those things. And so I gave a snap answer. And I did intend to mislead. If I had thought about it ahead of time, I would have thought of some evasion. I don't think this can properly be called an evasion. I might have said, well, do you really want to talk about mitigation and damages? Or are we going to settle this? Because if you want to talk about mitigation and damages, sure, it's going to be more than, it might be more than $2,000. Are we going to end this now or not? And the chances are he would have accepted that, which was a non-answer. But I had not. I'm not pleased with my answer. I can justify it, but I don't think it's a fair or proper justification. But I do think that equivocation, evasion, not answering at all, by changing the subject or however, is entirely proper, and I wouldn't feel bad if I had done that. Now, there's another issue that's discussed in lawyers' ethics, and that is the lawyer who over-identifies with the client. It's inevitable that we are going to side with our side, but in a way, I was the client. I believed in the cause. I was really... Oh, that's very interesting, too. We've mentioned Alice Kaczynski, the Ninth Circuit judge, very conservative. And we have some stuff about Kaczynski in the materials. He's a good buddy of... Scalia's, and their thinking is very similar, and I raised the question I wrote two columns on this, and in the first I simply raised the question and invited responses as to whether I had acted unethically, and Kaczynski emailed me and said, "You did nothing improper. Bigots deserve anything they get." but candidly, I think it was improper. Although the first one, saying "Don't be silly, $1,000 never going to do it," is
as the comment explains, it's expected. It's an understandable and accepted part of negotiations. And in that sense, it's just a form of equivocation. You might not agree, and I couldn't argue with you if you disagree. It is a falsehood. And then there's also a question of the importance of the word material here, which a second-year student who was in this course last year is writing a note on for the law review. What does the word material mean? In the law of evidence, the word material simply means the same as relevant. It has a tendency to prove or disprove something at issue. That's all. It's very, very tenuous. Whereas, in other contexts, the word material can mean something very different. It can mean outcome determinative, that it will determine the outcome of it, not simply tend to prove something, but it determines how it's going to come out. And there's an interesting question as to what the word material means here and elsewhere in the ethical rules. Right, any questions, comments on anything up to here? Okay. Ms. Davis.
At an early point, the manager lawyers and justice go to the case for a thousand.
Whoa, I just moved on. You're going to read it, please.
Okay.
Read it.
At an early point, the manager lawyers suggested selling the case for a thousand.
Loudly.
I responded that I was not authorized even to consider anything below five figures.
Yes.
But eventually you had an offer for 2,000. You still accepted below five figures. Was there any?
Well, of course. We weren't going to get any more than that. And if we delayed beyond that, I mean, I've been told by my client to take it. With regard to whether to accept an offer of settlement, that is something that must be communicated to the client, even if the lawyer thinks it's absurd. And the lawyer is bound, absolutely bound by the client's decision in that regard. It's one of the very interesting issues in the movie The Verdict with Paul Newman, where I think I mentioned the connection with the scaffolding, the longshoreman and the scaffolding problem, where the lawyer did not communicate to the client the offer of settlement because he thought he could do much better and he was afraid the client would take it. That happened in The Verdict. In the movie, wonderful movie. There was no problem with taking less than five figures, and the other lawyer was not. He didn't say, "Hey, I thought you couldn't take more than five figures." I mean, he knew damn well that it might well. In fact, if he literally believed me, he would never come back with 2,000. He thought that that would do it, and he was right. In fact, I might have tried to get him to 2.5 or something of that sort. But at that point, again, I just wanted to grab it as fast as possible. There's another hand. Shaman Thomas? No. Oh, yes. Okay, go on.
In this case, has the manager hotel found out that the organization was able to get a second offer? Could they just bring a case to make the damages back anyway?
They could have. Mr. Thanasan, they could have, but they really did not want any association
of the Manger Hotel name with the Managing Society. It was that simple. They would never, and it wouldn't have been worth it to them to litigate over $2,000 and whether I had misled them and so on. It just wouldn't have been worth it. They were very happy to walk away for $2,000. Ms. Guevara?
Am I allowed to go back to the question you opened class?
Yes, of course.
The way that I
wait, you're on 2708 now. Would everybody turn there, please? Yeah. Yeah.
Given the two prompts in that question, the way, the less tortured way that I extracted from it was to.
Yeah, now what we're concerned about is the concluding clause in 708 that there should be due credit for proceeds of resale, which wipes out the damages, and you've got a number of clearly inappropriate solutions, like you read that to refer only to scrap, which is just silly and inconsistent anyway with the legislative history, and the wonderful suggestion of White and Summers, who are very serious. Incidentally, among the one-volume treatises, among the case books, that's about the only one that's really respectable, in my view. And partly because, from time to time, White and Summers disagree, and they argue it out in the book. Why one thinks it goes one way, the other goes the other way. But that's, if that is wonderful, we'll just make believe it isn't there. There's no way to read it to come out with the right result. And everybody agrees that the right result is to recognize the lost volume seller. So just ignore it and get on with it. Yeah, go on.
So, yes, given that, I went back to the New York Rules of Construction Interpretation.
Yes.
And Section 98 seems to be the most political one because it speaks to harmonizing all parts of a particular statute or section. And since this is 2708, it's seller's damages, and it's intended to protect bond sellers.
But what are you harmonizing it with?
The rest
of the statute says all you get is the difference between this and that.
But when one part's in...
And this and that, it comes to the same number. Here. And in any significant lost volume seller case, that's the problem. Is that the second buyer bought the Mustang. The second buyer bought the diagnostic equipment. The second buyer comes along and the seller mitigates her damages.
But isn't it just the last sentence that kind of messes up the whole paragraph? The whole paragraph has a tendency to support the loss.
Well, it doesn't. And remember, we are relegated to 2708 on the assumption that we have acted in bad faith and in a commercially unreasonable manner. That's how we get into 708 from 706 in the first place. So if you're going to talk about the code structure and harmonizing it, then don't you have to harmonize the idea that 2708 is inferior to 706? It's where you get relegated if you're a bad person. That's the structure, isn't it? That you've got to harmonize. Mr. Raindorf?
I have a question about that.
Yeah.
Why can't you go straight to 2708?
Why can you not?
Yeah.
Well, I guess you can, except that if you're going to take seriously the rule
that is generally recognized that Ms. Chavara suggests, then you look at the whole structure. And the structure, the relevant other provision, tells you, you don't go straight to 708. You go to 708 if you've been a bad person, if you've acted in bad faith and in a commercially unreasonable manner, you're relegated to 2708.
Right, but I thought in the UCC you could choose whatever option is available to you.
Well, that's where do you get that from? 2703. Good. Yeah, that's another. No, I don't expect you to memorize the numbers. I just happen to remember that one. I think I've got it right. Yes, they do say that you get a choice and they're cumulative and all of that. But okay, so you go straight to 2708. And you still have to subtract the proceeds of resale. You still have to give due credit for the proceeds of resale.
With the harmonizing thing?
What's that?
With the harmonizing. Do they mean harmonize with regard to Article 2 in general, or the subsection, or the whole?
It can mean anything you want it to mean. But you see the references to the code structure by people who then do not even pay any attention to the code structure. Because you mentioned one aspect of the code structure, which is 2703. You've got all of these choices for the seller. And you take the choice you want. But then you've got 2706, which you have to harmonize with. And that makes it very clear that only bad people go to 708 as punishment for acting in bad faith and in a commercially unreasonable manner. So the structure argument doesn't really do it here. But there's more. There's more in those notes. And I think it's particularly in subsection B of that note, yeah. Always remember that words have variable meanings. Words are elastic. Words are accordion-like. They can be made broader and narrower, and even mean something that, like spring. Spring can mean a bed spring. It can mean a spring in the woods. It can mean a jump. It can mean all kinds of things. Mr. Samuels.
I think that you could, it's possible to interpret 2708B as where if the measure of damages is the profit that's expected, and the credit for payments is the proceeds of the resale beyond the what the cost of the contract is. So, for instance, if I had a contract to sell a car for $1,000. And he said, I'm not buying the car, but I was able to resell it for $1,200. And then I come to him and say,
oh, no, it doesn't. It does not mean you have to give him back $200.
No, I don't have to give him back. But when I now say, you know, I sue you for $1,000, he says, no, you don't. Not for $1,000. The court will say $800 because $200 already applies to the extra $1,000 that I was going to make.
Well, I don't think there's any authority for that kind of analysis. It's an interesting argument. I'm not sure how you get that out of due credit for proceeds of resale.
Well, otherwise,
I mean, the proceeds of the resale are $1,200.
The resale beyond what the original contract was worth.
It doesn't say that, but okay, it's an interesting point. I don't think it gets any place, but but that doesn't mean it's not a thoughtful suggestion. Ms. Guevara?
I'm a little nervous at this point, but the, what I meant by what I meant by a harmonizing, using a harmonizing argument, was within just 2708 sub 2 and harmonizing that last problematic clause with that paragraph and the intent behind that paragraph, but that is not, that's a misery.
I don't think that's a structural argument. I'm not sure where it gets it, frankly, as it's simply a matter of logic. Now look, one of the things we have emphasized is the variable nature of words. Take each word. Just focus on each one word at a time and see what you can do with that particular word. With the thought in mind, that word does not mean what I thought it meant the first 6 times I read this. That word really means something different. Or that word, in one case, that word really means something, whereas it seems to be redundant, perhaps. Or that word means something very different in this context from the way it is usually used. Look at 708, look at the clause, see, this is where you read a statute. Look at the words, and take the words one at a time, and see what you can do with each of those words. What is appropriate? What is proper? And you would say, then, what?
That's proper for Diasonics to receive its money as lost by himself.
Well, yeah, but I want you to explain then what the clause do credit to the proceeds of resale means, if that's the way you are reading the word do. Do credit. Meaning not the credit that is owed from the proceeds of resale, but the credit that is due, that is appropriate in this case for the proceeds of resale. Is appropriate where the resale has been made by a lost volume seller. What credit is proper? What credit is due in that sense for the proceeds of resale where the reseller
is a lost volume. So, Ms. Williams?
The profits of that sale?
Not it, but
the profits of that sale that was lost. The appropriate
Well, explain that. Explain that. Make the argument.
The lost volume seller has lost that one sale, so they are, you know, instead of selling 200, they sold 199 to put them back in the position that they would have been.
Not to put them back. In expectancy, you're looking forward, not putting anybody back. But no, you're making it, I think, more difficult than that. Ms. Freeberg?
So the appropriate proceeds of resale for lost volume seller are the net profits that would have been made from selling that particular product, that particular good that was being sold. That are the proceeds of that exact sale.
So the resale cancels out the damage.
Yes, if the resale includes the net profit that would be made.
Well, that's not an argument. Mr. Papadopoulos?
Well, like he was saying, the expected volume, it goes down. You expect to be in a certain position, and because of the breach, you're not in the expected position that you...
Yes, and therefore, the proceeds of resale that are due in the case of the lost volume seller is how much? Ms. Hart?
If you've only sold one as a result of the breach and you should have sold two, then the due credit, which is appropriate, would be the amount of both of those sales, not just the one. So it would be the profit.
No, you have to give due credit for the proceeds of the resale. You're going backwards. You're expressing, you have the right idea, but you're expressing it backwards. First letter. Ms. Pierce.
So the proceeds from the resale in the case of the lost volume seller are not due, so the credit is actually zero.
Exactly. If you're talking about a lost volume seller, there is no proceeds of resale are due because the lost volume seller then is not put in the position that he would have been in if that contract had been performed. And therefore, he had two sales instead of one. That was his expectancy. Or 200 instead of 199. That was his expectancy. And therefore, no proceeds of resale in the case of the lost volume seller is due, appropriate, proper. Okay. What else?
I think a better argument, but
take it. Find another word. Find another word. There aren't that many words in the clauses. Mr. Williams?
I'm sorry, could you just go over that one more time, real quick?
All right. The 2708 clearly is attempting to put the seller in the position that the seller would have been in from full performance. That's what it says. And then it goes on to say that in doing that, the seller must, or when you're making the calculation, you must give due credit for proceeds of resale by the seller. If the seller is a lost volume seller, then no proceeds of resale are due. No proceeds of resale are appropriate. No proceeds of resale are proper. If you were to read it the way it has been read, then you're not putting the lost volume seller in the position that that section of the UCC clearly intends. So the question of what is due credit for resale, where is a lost volume seller, is no credit is due if the seller resells for the same kind of item at the same price. Yeah. I'm not asking you to buy this. I just want you to see it as a way of arguing, as a way of reading. But I think the easier, clearer argument hasn't been made yet. Ms. Franco?
I was looking at the word resale.
All right, look at the word resale.
I was thinking that it's not actually a resale, it's more like a resale.
That's what the note says. That's just what the note says. Before the case, it's when the lost volume seller sells the same Mustang, he's not selling the same Mustang. It's not a resale. It's an additional sale. So no proceeds of resellers due because he hasn't made a resale. He's made a new sale. He's made an additional sale because he's a lost volume seller. And so we understand resale to mean the ordinary mitigation or cover situation where there's only this one item to sell and it is resold. But if there are a number of items to be sold, an infinite number or a greater number than this particular, it's not a resale, properly understood. Okay. Again, I'm not asking you to buy it, but just recognize how one can read. Manipulate, if you want. Alright, so, for next week, I think it'd be great if you prepare through what will almost certainly be the end of the course, that is, through page 290. And there's some stuff in there. There's some stuff in there that falls under the rubric of rhetoric, and we've got at least two rhetoricians in the room, so I'd like some contributions on that.